From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. John Wells and I are actually out this week. We're taking a much needed break. We'll be back next week. So we decided to bring you a couple of our favorite interviews from the last 6 months. We're probably like many of you. You hear a great radio show or a podcast, but it's always great to hear it again to cement the learning or maybe just to hear what you missed while you were ordering your coffee at that drive-thru. We kick it off with Christopher Kemp. Christopher is a science writer at Michigan State University, and he has a profound skill for portraying science with the soul of a storyteller. He has written a book. I love this topic. It's about the brain regions that orient us in space, or maybe fail to orient us in space. His book is Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation. And then we'll speak with ocean scientist, journalist, and author Julie Burwald. She shares the far-reaching consequences of coral reef destruction and the persistent efforts to keep them alive. What I love about this interview is she talks about hope and some projects that are really moving us forward and repairing coral reefs. All this coming up this hour. It's Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
And just a quick update, there is a small herd of elk attempting to cross 224 on the east side of the highway this morning. So if you're driving down 224, please be careful. And now we get into the Christopher Kemp.
We turn to our brain's ability to navigate. It's one of our most ancient abilities. Our guest is molecular biologist Christopher Kemp. Now, Christopher embarks on a journey to discover the remarkable extent of what our minds can do. And this is funny. He's fueled by his own spatial shortcomings. He describes the brain's regions that orient us in space and the specialized neurons that do it. His new book is called Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation. Christopher, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. And I love that you're so self-effacing that you start off by describing the difference in ability to navigate between you and your wife.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And, you know, my wife is an incredible, graceful navigator. She's able to do things that, to me, seem completely supernatural. We'll go places that we haven't been to in years, and she'll be able to point out the hotels we've stayed in and the restaurants we've eaten at. And she just seems to have this very informative map just kind of stored away in her brain for her to use at any time. And when I see her doing these things, I know that that's something that my brain is just really not doing very well. And so that's what really sort of sent me down the path of researching this book and trying to work out a little bit more what determines where we all fall on that spectrum.
Right. And I would say that it doesn't necessarily relate to intelligence, or it doesn't at all. I mean, you're a molecular biologist. You've now written a book that's been published by a reputable publishing house. You're an intelligent man, but you do not shine when it comes to this area of being able to navigate. And so why is it that it's not connected to intelligence?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really interesting. It's when people look at the brain, there's all these different ways to measure our brain's function. So you could look at things like attention, our ability to sort of hold attention, or our executive functioning. And what neuroscientists have found is that when they look at what we call a cognitive domain, like spatial reasoning, that has just a much wider spectrum of ability than any other function that they've looked at. So what that really means is that within that spectrum, some people are just incredibly good, really, really gifted navigators, and some people are terribly bad. They they can't find their way out of a paper bag, and they drive past their own house sometimes. And yeah, it's not linked to intelligence at all. Although I think it's fair to say that in a very large way, it is linked to memory. If you want to simplify what navigation is, it's memory. It's performed by a lot of the brain structures that are also involved in memory. And so, you know, you could be a very intelligent and sort of slightly forgetful person, I think. One of my wife's sort of pet theories all along in the time that we've been married is that I don't pay enough attention. And I've always said, come on, you know, that's ridiculous. It's my brain not working. But one of the things that I discovered in writing the book, I have an appendix at the end that sort of provides some pointers on what people can do to become better navigators. And I don't like to tell my wife that she's right. But at the same time, the most important point on that list is to pay attention. You know, we rely on this notion of a cognitive map. It's kind of, it's an internal representation of the world that we build in our brains. And the part of the brain that does that is the hippocampus, and that's the part of the brain that is involved in memory. And so if you want to build an accurate and informative map that then you can sort of, you can close your eyes and then you can interrogate that internal map to tell you where to go, the only way to build a good map is to pay attention. And so in that respect, she was dead right. So yeah, it's completely divorced from intelligence, but it's definitely, you know, everybody's different. The thing that I really came to terms with during this journey of kind of learning more about my brain is that my inability to navigate is right up there with my ability to play a musical instrument, or my whether or not I'm an empathic person, whether I can feel people's pain and feelings, or whether I'm an anxious person, or whether I need a lot of sleep or a little sleep. I mean, this is just one of those other things that is determined by our brain that eventually, when you put them all together, makes us who we are.
Well, this is very interesting. Hey, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is molecular biologist Christopher Kemp. He's written Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation. As I heard, yourself and Lynn talking about the difference between your wife and yourself, the thing that struck me was that she's not only good with directions, but she remembers the restaurants and what she had and, you know, all those different pieces. So then I started thinking, well, it's not intelligence, it could be memory. And then, yeah, it is paying attention, and maybe you're indifferent to the restaurants that you go to or how to navigate to that restaurant, but you're very focused on certain things. So is it a question of focus?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because I think it is. I remember a particular instance when we were in London, and we were at Covent Garden, which is a big, bustling, busy part of the city, and my wife asked me to try to get us back to our hotel, and I realized that I had been watching a pigeon eat a donut. And you know, the most important part of the story was that the pigeon had one leg. It was a one-legged pigeon eating a donut. And how can you not look at that? But yeah, it had taken all of my attention. I didn't really know where I was anymore. And it's, you know, that sparked kind of a larger discussion that we have often between the two of us. And I think it probably happens in lots of marriages. I pay attention, but possibly not to the right things. So I think that's a very insightful way of looking at it. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to meet that pigeon. I mean, a one-legged pigeon eating a donut. I'd be very interested in that as well. I'm curious about the whole muscle thing of use it or lose it. We have our phones. It's easy to just throw the directions in and have this thing take you wherever you want to go in all sorts of granularity and details of driving directions. Are we becoming less efficient in being able to navigate because we use our phones too much?
Definitely. Yeah, 100% we are. So scientists, for the last couple of decades, we have this technology called fMRI, which is the ability to put people who are awake into a scanner that can kind of detect changes in the activity levels of different brain structures. And we can do this with people, and we can ask them to navigate a virtual environment. And when we do that, if we just ask them to kind of explore and walk around these sort of cartoony looking streets, we see that this hippocampus, the region that's really most involved in navigation, you can see that it lights up. It suddenly becomes very active. But then if you take those same people and you give them instructions and you tell them, you know, just as you would have with a GPS, you tell them to walk straight, take the first left, travel down two streets, take another right. If you get them to just do those turn-by-turn instructions, then that hippocampus just goes completely silent. It's just completely inactivated. And that essentially is what's happening when we just put the coordinates in and just follow the instructions. We're no longer building a map. We've stopped looking at our surroundings. We've stopped taking in landmarks and all those really important data points that we use to navigate by. And scientists have essentially asked people to draw maps of an environment and asked them then how often they use GPS to get around. And they've shown that people who use GPS devices the most draw less informative maps. And it's because they have become hardwired. We've become trained to notice fewer things because we are shown fewer things. GPS maps are actually quite uninformative, usually. They have kind of, they have where we're leaving from, and they have the destination, and they have the route between that, but they don't have all the richness of an environment would. They don't have landmarks and distinctive buildings and the smell and the sound of things. And so in the end, what we build is a really poor, uninformative map.
Christopher, I have memories of sitting down with my mother, and she had these flashcards to help me learn my multiplication tables. And that was something that was important in school, and she took it upon herself to make sure I had all my tables down and, you know, those sorts of things. But no one's ever talked to me about directions and things like that. Is it maybe a function of what we learn in school or what we focus on in school?
I think that is part of it. Yeah, you know, in the book I write about some other cultures, and you know, there's a culture in Bolivia, in the part of the Amazon rainforest that's in Bolivia, and they're called the Chimani people, and they basically live in the jungle alongside a river, and researchers have shown that they are just incredible navigators. You can sort of spin them around on the spot and stop them and ask them to point to the next settlement in the jungle, even though they can't see it. You know, it's through the trees and everything looks the same, and they can point to it with incredible accuracy. And that's because that's part of their lives. It's part of their culture. It's part of how children are taught to navigate and to sort of integrate themselves with the world. And I think part of a modern life in the Western world is that we are not taught those same things, and especially with the advent of GPS, that just sort of deepens that problem.
Christopher, when you talk about the Chimani people in the Amazon, I think it's so interesting. It makes me reflect on, you know, we live in the West where there are big, wide open spaces, and we often orient ourselves by which mountain range is over there. That mountain range runs north and south, and it's on, you know, the east side of the valley. That's the Salt Lake Valley, the Wasatch Mountains are on the east side of the valley. And if you ever get lost, you just look to where the mountains are, and then you know which way is north and south and so on. And I found that when people from the West go back to the East Coast, where, or the Northeast, for example, where it's heavily treed, they get a sense of disorientation because they can't, they don't have those points, those topographical points. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if you have gone into this sort of thing. But it sounds like from the Chimani in the Amazon that maybe they don't have those reference points either, but something that they have done to practice that has developed that part of the hippocampus. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I always try to think of things in terms of, but how would a caveman respond to this kind of stuff? Because, you know, 200,000 years ago, we were just becoming Homo sapiens. We were just becoming our modern species. And for almost the entirety of the existence of our species, we haven't really moved around a lot. You know, wherever you were born, you probably died pretty close to that location, and you probably didn't move around all that much. So I think a lot of it is just that we become hardwired to whatever location we became really comfortable navigating in. So if you grew up in the trees, then you probably, that's part of your, you know, gestalt, as part of your environment. And then if you grew up out west by the mountains, then that was probably really integral to how you navigated the world. I imagine that it's this huge amount of movement that we do in this modern era.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, a part of your book that I loved is that you have found through your research that male, female, young, old, no one is predisposed to have better navigational, a better internal compass than anyone else. And I love to hear this because while it's probably generational, my dad has this idea that men can navigate and women can't. And I say to him, because I happen to have a very good, I'm just lucky, I have a very good sense of ability to navigate, and even to the point where I can prove him wrong, and I love when I do it. But I think in this case, it has to do with the fact that he drives everywhere and my mom doesn't. She just rides alongside and she doesn't pay attention. But talk to us a little bit about the difference between male, female, you know, young and old when it comes to navigation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it is a really, it's probably one of my favorite aspects of my reporting, because it has a little bit of social justice to it. You know, this idea that women are somehow inferior navigators. I mean, in our own household, it certainly doesn't ring true. And so, you know, one of the problems about making these enormous generalizations about everybody is that we just haven't been able to do it. You know, a lot of the studies are on university campuses where they recruit 20 or 30 subjects and then they put them through some navigational tests, and then they say something about humans, which is kind of a ridiculous thing to do. And so a researcher called Hugo Spears basically came up with a smartphone app which has some navigational components to it. And you know, within a couple of weeks of it being released, there were 6 million people using this app. And suddenly you can look at people and say, well, this is what humans do. And they've crunched these mountains of data, and they show that men and women are equally good or bad at navigating if women are free. If they're free to drive and leave the house and have bank accounts and vote and do all those things that that women in egalitarian countries can do, and that women in some countries are not able to do. And I thought that was really interesting. And it comes down to that same point that you made about your mom and dad. If your dad always did the driving, he was always engaging with the environment and building those maps. And if your mom was the passenger, then it's that use it or lose it sort of idea. Yeah, it's totally a fiction that culture, it just seems convenient for us to be, oh, well, women can't navigate at all. But, you know, clearly that's a very old-fashioned mode of thinking that we can put away.
I can't wait to give him your book.
Yeah, he may not read it.
He might not. Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting. There are differences between men and women. Like women, women seem to perform better at object location memory tests. They remember where everything is. Men seem to outperform women at mental rotation tasks. So being shown an object and, you know, those tests, I don't know if you've ever seen those tests, but it looks like they show you an object made of different blocks, sort of a strangely shaped object. And then they show you three other objects. And only one of them is the first object that's been rotated in some way. And people who are really good at that test can look at the first object and kind of close their eyes and mentally rotate it just in their brain and sort of view it from other perspectives and tell you which of the other three objects is that first one rotated. Now, I'm terrible. I mean, I can feel my brain sort of clenching when I do that. And it just clearly doesn't perform the job that I'm asking it to do. Men typically are better than women at that. But it does seem that that's, even that is cultural. It's not like an evolutionary. It's not the brain that women are born with. Because if you let women play video games for 12 hours a day for a couple of weeks, or if you train them in origami for a few months, then they suddenly can perform mental rotation tasks as well as men can. So, yeah.
Well, Christopher, I agree with my co-host that in the Northeast, we have more trees and we have a different way of navigating, and it's more wide open out here in the West and we have mountains, but there's something else going on. And it's something culturally, and I've talked to people from Boston before. I'm from Boston, downtown Boston. This is how you navigate. You go up to a cop and you say, can you tell me how to get to so-and-so? He says, yeah. You just two blocks that way, bang a left where the car's up on blocks, and there's probably a bum hanging out there. Go down three more blocks, bang a right, and that's how you get directions. There's something going on out here in Salt Lake, though, because you need to have your compass points. And everyone is always saying, yeah, well, take 5th Street in a northeastern way and then head south and then go northwest on so-and-so. And that's the way. And I've talked to people from Boston that have come out to Salt Lake and said, well, I don't know what they're talking about. I got to go out and buy a compass now. I got to figure out where the sun's setting. I mean, Lynn, have you heard people complain about that before that are not from here?
Yes, it's true. It's that grid. We have the north, south, east, and west, the way the streets are called in the Salt Lake Valley. And I think that is like a lot of people from Boston aren't hardwired that way.
Yeah. And we also, once we get the navigation, we drive differently. We go right on red, left on red, straight through a red. We can even back through a red. Now, it's not necessarily legal, but that's the way we drive in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point because if I don't know if you're familiar with the term of entropy, you know, it's like chaos, things falling apart.
Yeah.
And scientists can measure how entropic a street network is for any city. So if a city is built on a grid like Salt Lake City or like New York City or Chicago, those cities are considered very, very non-entropic. They get a very low entropy score. And then cities that are older and tend to be less built on a grid structure, like Boston, or like a lot of medieval European cities, are considered entropic. And if you grew up in an entropic city, you tend to be much better at navigating because you've had to do some work. And if you grew up in a non-entropic city like Salt Lake City, where everything's just on a grid and it's like you're a mouse going through a maze, then you tend to have poorer spatial abilities.
Yeah. Oh, this topic is just so fascinating to me. And just maybe it's more of a remark or maybe it is a question about those who have a good ability to navigate. When they come up out of a subway, this is the time that I get completely disoriented. After I've been riding through a subway, I don't know where it's gone. I can't see. I come up and I don't know if to go left or right. Is that a thing? A real thing?
I mean, I don't know whether it's a thing or not. I just know that I struggle too. I mean, it's some people, I think, do manage to retain some idea of how they are moving through space, even though they're underground. You know, and if you're really familiar with the city that you're traveling in, I think of London. I've spent a lot of time underground in London. And for the people who travel that way all the time, I imagine they have this sense of where they're traveling through space. I don't, because I'm useless, but I think it's probably possible to have that.
Your wife probably would say she can do it. I love it. Christopher Kemp is our guest, and his book is Dark and Magical Places, The Neuroscience of Navigation. Christopher, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's been great.
Such fun. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Take care. And that was Christopher Kemp. Very fascinating topic. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Our next guest, Julie Burwald, received her PhD in ocean science from the University of Southern California. She is the author of Spineless, a very fascinating book about jellyfish. She's also a science textbook writer and editor, and she's written for the New York Times, Nature, National Geographic, and Slate. And she joins us today to discuss her new book, Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. It came from a passion for the oceans and a world in peril, especially for coral reefs. And it's also a book about a way forward. Julie Burwald, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's nice to have you.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here. Hi, John.
Well, tell us a little bit about sort of the genesis of this book. And I think we all have been either scuba or skin diving, where we see portions of coral reef that are dead, and it feels so, I don't know, it just feels so wrong. I don't know if we have this idea that something under the sea should be much healthier than something above ground, but what was your journey with this book?
I had never gone snorkeling till I was in college, and then I was on the study abroad program in Israel, and I was miserable. And so I kind of like saw the sign on a wall for like a marine ecology course, and I was like, sure, why not? So the next thing I knew, they were handing me a mask and a snorkel and fins, and I stuck my head into the Red Sea. And it was like, this was in the days before tons of documentaries, but like, I couldn't believe what was down there and just how much life and how beautiful and how diverse and how bustling it was. And I thought, I can't believe we live on the same planet as this. And I never knew it. And that, you know, that did change my life. I decided to become a marine biologist. But of course, life doesn't go the way you expect it to go all the time. And I didn't get into grad school to be a coral scientist. I got into grad school to study satellite imagery of the ocean. And, you know, but coral were always kind of that love that I held on to deep in my heart. And then after I became a science writer, I was following the story of the coral and reading about how the heating of the planet was affecting them so greatly. And I just felt like I wanted to write my second book about coral, but I couldn't just write an obituary. I just knew I wouldn't be able to write a whole book like that. But then I went to this meeting in Florida called Reef Futures, and it was a jolt, because all of these coral scientists and all these practitioners, these people who take care of local reefs, were saying, it's not over yet. We have a lot of tools. We have some innovations. We're doing some things that are helping the reefs. And I thought, well, you know, that's the kind of story I could sink my teeth into, you know, without being Pollyanna. Like, I want to say, like, it is an urgent and critical time for the health of the reefs worldwide. But that's not the end of the story. There's more nuance to it than that. And I wanted to help tell those pieces of the story.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that back then there weren't many documentaries. And I believe it debuted at the Sundance Film Festival, the documentary Chasing Coral, which I felt at the end like I just wanted to roll over and get into the fetal position and cry. That film, Chasing Coral, came out in 2017. So now, you know, we're 5 years down the road, and you're talking about It's not an obituary. It's not over. There is some hope. And what gives you the greatest hope?
I mean, so certainly there's like people out there doing cool things. And in fact, one of the stars of Chasing Coral, Richard Beavers, he ends up being a main character in my book as well. Yeah, because he has an interesting point of view about trying to be like the advertising agency for the coral reefs. And I think that the coral reefs tend to fade from our minds so frequently. So what he's trying to do is pretty interesting. But you asked, like, what is the hope? So in terms of people, I mean, there's all kinds of exciting restoration projects. And this is kind of a philosophical shift, because for a long time in the ocean, we talked about conservation, which means just getting out of the way of nature. But this is actively playing a role in restoring coral reefs. And it's happening in different ways around the world, because the reefs are all different all over the world. You know, one of the coolest ones I saw was in Sulawesi. And this one is the Mars Candy Bar Company has created it. And they're the biggest problem right now is blast fishing, which is where locals will fish using explosives. And that causes the reef to turn to rubble. But they have come up with this system called Reef Stars, which are these rebar structures that they network together, and they can plant 100,000 coral in a couple days. They've restored hectares of reef, which is nothing compared to what's out there. But the reefs are beautiful, and it's really working. And so that's a story of hope. In the Caribbean, one of the big problems is that the coral are now so spread out from each other that they're not really reproducing very well. So there's these massive IVF projects where they collect the spawn, make tons and tons of larvae, let those larvae settle down on these kind of tinker toy shaped rock sort of things. And then they can replant hundreds of thousands of coral every year to help boost the populations. So there's things that we're doing that are pretty amazing, but then there's also the things that the coral are doing. That may be the source of some of the greatest hope. The coral themselves are animals like we are, but they depend on this algae that lives in their tissue and photosynthesizes like all plants do, and then feeds the coral about 90% of the sugar that they make. And what bleaching is when the water heats up, the algae leave the coral, taking away their color and leaving them. The coral themselves are clear tissue, but what you see is this white skeleton that they make underneath. So they look like bones. They look like bleached out bones. And when the algae leave, they take not just the color, but they also take the nutrition that they usually feed the coral also. And so the corals start to starve. But what's happening in some places is if the water cools down, the coral can be reinfected with algae again. And in some places, there's a new strain of algae infecting the coral. And that new strain actually can tolerate higher temperatures, like a degree and a half top. Higher, but there's always a but, right? The algae, those new algae, these more thermotolerant ones, only feed the coral about 60% of the sugar they make. So the coral are kind of trading out business partners for one. It's almost like having a new tenant. It'll pay you a little bit less rent because your air conditioner isn't working, but at least it's paying some rent. So, you know, we don't know what's happening, but it is a form of innovation. And we're just kind of, these are these unfolding stories that are happening.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Julie Burwald, and she has written Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. Well, Julie, I find that fascinating. I mean, there is this relationship between the algae and the coral. When the temperatures do rise, the algae kind of, you know, the relationship breaks up. This whole thing about if the waters were to cool, then the algae moves back in, but the original algae has perished because of the higher temperatures in the first place, or it's the algae's just moved on to do something else?
Yeah, so these algae can live inside the coral, and they like it there because the coral provides a home for them and also supplies them with fertilizer, basically nitrogen and phosphorus, the things that any plant needs to grow. But the algae, when they leave the coral, they can just swim away into the ocean. They grow a tail, a little flagella, and they just swim off and they're happy out there in the ocean. Of course, it's a little more dangerous out there because they can get eaten by things. But yeah, they can survive outside of the coral. They don't need the coral. You could say the coral need them more than they need the coral.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I didn't know until I read your book that the collapse of the reefs also shifts people from eating high traditional protein diets to other types of diets that don't have the same nutritional value or protein. And those are mostly people that are in third world nations.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you think about, so coral reefs, the kind we're talking about, in tropical waters. And so, you know, those parts of the world, the temperate parts of the world tend to be what we sort of call developed nations. And so, and tropical places tend to be sort of less developed, as you said. And so they do rely on reefs more directly for the primary protein sources. And so as we see reefs collapse, we see people having to shift their diets to less healthy diets. And in fact, I mentioned that Mars restoration, the Mars candy bar restoration in Sulawesi, they have a chocolate factory in Sulawesi. And the people who work in the factory were having to shift from eating fish that they caught on the reef because the reefs weren't as healthy. And that's actually what first inspired them to do that restoration project. They realized that healthy reefs make for a better life for everybody. And so, yeah, I mean, this is what's at stake.
Julie, I had to look up where Sulawesi is. It's an Indonesian island. It's great to hear that there's a success story there. But going back to the reef stars and the rebar that's sticking up, and then I guess the bigger question is, how do you go about educating a population who has fished in this certain way by using explosives for probably, you know, a couple generations anyway? It's a very efficient, you know, air quotes, way of fishing. I'm sure that you've seen around the world the way of re-educating populations of people to see with the importance of what's going on here for their lifestyles and their diets and their health.
I would almost turn it around a little bit because one of the really important things that the coral scientists say, who work on reefs say, and you have to work with local populations wherever you are. If you just come in and say, we're going to do this restoration project, but you haven't worked with the people who live there, it's going to fail. And all that money will just be wasted. All that time and effort will just be wasted. So unless the local people are driving the restoration, are intimately involved in it, it really isn't going to be successful. And when we went to see the Mars project, the local people actually had like lobbied Mars to put the restoration around their island because they were already seeing that the fish populations were coming back due to the restoration project. The Mars team had actually done a previous restoration on a different island. And initially there was buy-in from the local people, but then the administration of the mayor, they got a new mayor basically who wasn't bought into it. And then that restoration failed after that. So it's you can't come in and say like, we're going to restore the coral, you know, like that's never going to work. So, So really it's not about re-education. It's more about like working together with.
Again, with that specific restoration project with the rebar and how you regrow or help the coral to grow, can you explain a little bit about that and how easy it is to do and how prolific the coral is?
Well, the thing about working in Indonesia, so coral reefs are not equal all over the world. There's a center of coral diversity. So that's called the Coral Triangle. And it's in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's between Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and the Philippines. It's kind of a triangle shape. It's not exactly a triangle shape. But anyway, something around 400 species of coral live in that part of the world. So you've got like this incredible like source of coral diversity to work with there. So they're working in like the prime real estate location to do a coral restoration. Comparatively, in the Caribbean, there's only about 44 species of coral, so 10 times less. So, you know, what you have to work with in the Caribbean is a lot less. But yeah, in Sulawesi, there are what are called corals of opportunity. So coral break and fragment off. So they have some of the fishermen go out and collect corals that are broken, and they know which ones will live at the certain depth where they're doing the restoration. They try to include something around 40 or 50 species when they do a restoration so that there's diversity there, so that if for whatever reason one kind of coral is actually not happy, the other ones can sort of take over. There's a little bit of a land grab among the coral that are put into a restoration spot. They kind of network. You tie using zip ties, you tie the coral on, and the fishermen pay the fishermen to do this work and use local divers also to do this. And they zip tie the coral onto these rebar structures, and then the rebar structures are moved to the restoration site and networked together and staked in place. And then they've discovered lots of like little details that make things successful. So if you put a restoration near a healthy reef, then the animals from the healthy reef start invading the restored site faster. And in fact, they've even discovered that a healthy reef, just like a healthy forest, has a certain audio environment. So it has like, it's not birds chirping, but the equivalent. So like fish grunting and shrimp snapping and the sounds of health. And they actually play the sounds of health on the restoration site. And the animals start showing up. They're like, oh, this is a good place to live. And so they start doing the things for the coral, like pruning away the algae that help the algae grow fast. I mean, help the coral grow faster. So they're doing a lot of things to make those restorations successful. And like I said, like after 3 years, these restorations look, you can't even tell it's a restoration. They're so beautiful.
Well, that is just fascinating about the audio clips, you know, encouraging this process to continue. And I'd like to know, in addition to the climate change going up a couple of degrees or a degree Celsius in our oceans, does the acidification of oceans, does that affect the coral reefs?
So that's a really cool question, an interesting question. So about 10 years ago, the story of acidification kind of got onto scientists' radar. And the ocean had, you know, the acidity had increased about 30% significantly. And at that time, everybody was like, this is going to be terrible for coral reefs. But in the intervening years, we've come to understand that the coral actually are kind of masters at dealing with acidification. And I'm speaking really broadly here because there's so many species of coral and they live in such different environments. But in general, so far, the coral actually control acidic pH really, really well. In fact, in the little bubble where the algae that, you know, the symbiont lives, they actually make that very acidic, because that makes carbon dioxide more available for the algae to photosynthesize. And then around the place where they lay down their skeleton, they actually change the pH of the water around that area too and make it more basic, because that helps calcium carbonate form, helps limestone form more easily. So they're actually manipulating the pH really in a really sophisticated manner, and they are capable of doing that. So a living coral is, as one scientists told me they don't care. A living coral just doesn't care. But a dead coral, which is just limestone, does care. And so in places where the reefs where the coral are not living anymore and you just have the reef structure, those places are dissolving away at a much higher rate than in the past because the coral isn't there to manipulate the pH. So yeah, so that's mm-hmm. kind of the story.
Julie, I was told that for every 3 breaths that a human being takes, we can thank the oceans for 2 of them because of the plant life that, of course, is... So we'll get to this myth because there's a carbon capture and there's the photosynthesis, which is giving off oxygen. So it sounds like you have quite a reaction to what I just said. So why don't you go ahead?
Okay, this is one of my best, biggest pet peeves of all time. And so thank you for asking me about it because I want to clarify this.
Okay.
This is a misconception. So here it is. What we are breathing right now is the result of cyanobacteria, which are ancient bacteria that can photosynthesize and put oxygen into the atmosphere. That has accumulated over 3 billion years.
Yes.
So that's the bulk of the oxygen in our atmosphere. Every year, the land and the oceans give off about the same amount of oxygen through photosynthesis, but that amount, and they're about equal, but that amount is minuscule compared
to
the giant reservoir of oxygen that's already been put in our atmosphere. So if the oceans die, which, you know, you hear, we'll still be able to breathe.
Yeah.
There's so much oxygen in the reservoir of our atmosphere already that the exchange, yearly exchange, daily exchange, whatever you want, a century exchange, is nothing. It's minuscule. So that is a big pet peeve of mine, and I see it all the time on websites and in movies, and it's not true.
Well, I'm glad we talked about it.
Me too. I don't get the chance to talk about it very frequently.
Okay,
I just pull my hair out.
I had another question just before we let you go, about a minute left. Obviously, you are so passionate about this. It's palpable, and we can see it in your face on our Zoom call. We can hear it in your voice. You also weave into the story or the journey of your daughter, who is dealing with some mental health issues. In a way, you're drawing parallels between the life of the coral, the life of your daughter. Can you just tell us what that part is about? Because it makes up a really interesting element of this book as well.
I kind of struggled with that. In Spineless, as I was telling the story of the jellyfish, I was also kind of going back to these places I'd been in grad school, and I'd had sort of a bad boyfriend at that time. And so those stories kind of got woven into the book. And so I kind of am used to writing memoir with science and sort of letting them hopefully enhance each other's story. In this book, I really didn't think I was going to do that. I thought I was going to tell the story of the coral and my travels and this, but my daughter got very sick at the beginning of this book with a mental illness, as you said. I didn't think that they connected, but as I started writing more and more about the sickness on the reef, I started seeing these parallels, which too were really important, which is that the coral, as we've talked about, are kind of invisible to us up here on land. And similarly, mental health can be very invisible as well. I mean, if you saw my daughter, you wouldn't know how much she was struggling and how sick she was. But yet both things are so foundational. I mean, we've talked about how important the corals, they're disproportionately important for the health of the oceans. And mental health, I mean, without the foundation of mental health, what it is to be human becomes very, very almost impossible. So the stories wound together, and I ended up kind of writing them together, especially as the COVID crisis hit, that things became more interconnected in timeline. And I sent a little bit of it to my editor, and I said, is this the right thing to do? And she just said, I think it's some of your most powerful writing. And so I talked to my daughter about it, and she said, yes. She's like, I don't think mental health should have the stigma that it has. The more we talk about it, the better for all of us. And I'm I'm good with you including this in the story in this book. And so that's how it happened. And hopefully it does. Hopefully they do enhance each other. That's my hope.
It shows the interconnectedness of humans and the coral reef and all of our plight, right?
Yes,
the book
exactly.
is Life on the Rocks, Building a Future for Coral Reefs. Our guest is Julie Burwald. Julie, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
It's been an honor to be here. Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you want to share it, all our shows are under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows. Wherever you find your podcast, you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a comment. If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. You're listening to KPCW in Park City.